Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group in partnership with Roslyn Capital. I'm Hugh Hewitt. In the face of media chatter, taunts, and whining, President-elect Donald Trump is busy moving his transition team forward. He followed tradition, appearing with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes. Mr. Trump was unflappable, even presidential.
A lot of people have been surprised by how reasonable Trump seems to have become.
Trump has a formidable team putting together the myriad details and strategies involved in moving forward an ambitious GOP agenda.
I think a lot of misconception about who his key team is. It's Mike Flynn on national security, the retired general. It's Jared Kushner, his son-in-law. Steve Bannon, his chief strategist. And Jeff Sessions, the Alabama senator. That's your core group.
Along the way, there's been a lot of griping and anger about America's electoral college system. Is it justified?
16% of her vote from California and New York by themselves. So we don't want a presidential election system where New York and California can pick presidents for us.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Our city streets and campuses are quieting down after a week of demonstrations against President-elect Donald Trump. The world must have been somewhat bemused by the sight of grown-ups crying and teenagers screaming vulgar slogans against the election result. This is not a particular surprise to us, judging from the bitterness in the campaign and the unexpected election result. Nervous Trump supporters must have been surprised by Mr. Trump's changed tone. Ever since the night of his election victory, Trump has put forward a more disciplined demeanor, even in the face of hostile media. CBS 60 Minutes mainstay Leslie Stahl might have been surprised herself.
I want to ask you about the tweet that you put out. I think it was last night or the night before, about these demonstrators.
Yeah.
You said that they were professional.
I said
it was unfair.
Some of them are. Yeah.
But are you going to be tweeting and whatever you're upset about just put out there
so
when you're president?
It's a modern form of communication between Facebook and Twitter and I guess Instagram. I have 28 million people. 28 million
so
people.
So you are going to keep it up.
It's a great form of communication. Now, do I say I'll give it up entirely and throw out? That's a tremendous form. I picked up yesterday 100,000 people. I'm not saying I love it, but it does get the word out.
Conservatives had doubtless been worried. Could Donald Trump shed his bad boy campaign image and become, quote, presidential? Michael Medved analyzed the 60 Minutes interview on his program.
A lot of people have been surprised by how reasonable Trump seems to have become. For instance, he said to some of the racist supporters that Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes asked him about, he gave a very unequivocal message. Listen.
I'm very surprised to hear that. I hate to hear that. I mean, I hate
but
to hear
But you do
it.
Hear it.
I don't hear it.
I saw one or two instances. On social media?
But I think
media?
It's a very small amount. Again, I think it's
do
the media.
Do you want to say anything to those people?
I would say don't do it. That's terrible. Because I'm going to bring this country together.
They're harassing Latinos, Muslims.
I am so saddened to hear that. And I say stop it. If it helps. I will say this, and I'll say it right to the camera. Stop it.
Okay, that was good and appropriate. And again, what you could see there was he was resisting the temptation of arguing with Leslie Stahl. I might have argued with her because what she's saying is absurd. The number of incidents of people hanging Trump in effigy, of chanting things like F Trump and he's not my president, and truly, truly negative anti-American, worrisome things, the calls for days of rage and walkouts, the few incidents in Portland, Oregon of actual violence, the attacks on people because they are suspected Trump supporters, that has been much more serious, much more omnipresent, much more a part of our national life in the last couple of days than any real documented persecution of people based on race or gender or sexual orientation or religious faith or anything of the kind. Should Hillary be in jail, as Mr. Trump said several times in his campaign? Leslie Stahl asked him about it on 60 Minutes.
Are you going to ask for a special prosecutor to investigate Hillary Clinton over her emails? And are you, as you had said, to her face, going to try and put her in jail?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to think about it. I feel that I want to focus on jobs. I want to focus on health care. I want to focus on the border and immigration and doing a really great immigration bill. We want to have a great immigration bill. And I want to focus on all of these other things that we've been talking about.
You know,
get the country straightened away.
You called her crooked Hillary, said you wanted to get in jail. Your people in your audience has kept saying lock him up.
Yeah.
Well,
she did some bad things. I mean, she did some bad things.
A special prosecutor?
I don't want to hurt them. They're good people. I don't want to hurt them. And I will give you a very, very good and definitive answer the next time we do 60 Minutes together.
Don't know when the next time he's going to do 60 Minutes will be. But look, that was as good an answer as he could give. Really. I mean, he's exactly right. And he's right to say, I don't want to hurt them. They're good people. And isn't it appropriate that the country move on? And he actually was somewhat surprising talking about the presidential salary and his plans for vacations.
What about vacations? You're not going to take any vacations? You've said that.
We have so much work. There's so much work to be done. And I want to get it done for the people. I want to get it done. We're lowering taxes. We're taking care of health care. I mean, there's just so much to be done. So I don't think we'll be very big on vacations, no.
Are you going to take the salary, the president's salary?
Well, I've never commented on this, but the answer is no. I think I have to, by law, take $1. So I'll take $1 a year. But it's a, I don't even know what it is. Do you know what the salary is?
$400,000. Yeah,
no, I'm not going to take the salary. I'm not taking it.
Okay, good for him. I'm sort of surprised he didn't know what the salary was, but good for him. He becomes, by the way, only the second president who refused to accept a presidential salary. And I would imagine that Mr. Trump will end up with a more successful presidency than the first president who didn't take a salary. Here's a hint. The previous president who did not take a presidential salary was also someone who had never won elective office, though he had served in the cabinet. Okay, it was Herbert Hoover. I don't think Mr. Trump wants to replicate what happened to Herbert Hoover. His administration was ruined because a little interruption called the Great Depression occurred under his watch.
Now that the dust is settling and the very difficult work of transitioning the government begins, one wonders how organized Mr. Trump's team will become. Is there any structure to back up his campaign promises? And what about the myriad selection of cabinet members and some 4,000 other appointees? I spoke with political reporter Robert Costa of The Washington Post. Robert, would you begin with just sort of a factual statement of your understanding of how the transition is running?
So the transition began as a project that Trump didn't pay attention to, run by the New Jersey governor. Trump didn't want anything to do with it. He's superstitious in a way. Didn't want to touch transition until he won. Then he actually wins. He starts looking it over with his key team, and I think a lot of misconception about who his key team is. It's Mike Flynn on national security, the retired general. It's Jared Kushner, his son-in-law. Steve Bannon, his chief strategist, and Jeff Sessions, the Alabama senator. That's your core group. They looked at this Christie group, and they said, hey, we want to take control of this. And so some people were calling it a purge, but it was really, in a sense, that moving these people out from Christie world. They didn't want the Christie people all over the government, and kind of starting from a blank slate of people that Trump knew and trusted, and that's what's happening right now.
Now, in terms of these reports of chaos, I have been trying to tell people every transition passed, there was exactly one. Ronald Reagan didn't make appointments until the sixth week of his transition. Richard Nixon did not make appointments to the fifth week of his transition. George H.W. Bush made four appointments early in the second week. Bill Clinton didn't make appointments till like week six. This is crazy, Robert Costa. What's going on in the media? Does anyone, have they lost their historical perspective?
I think it's because he's an outsider. It's a lot like Jimmy Carter in 76 or Bill Clinton in 92, because this town, to use that phrase, I mean, it really doesn't matter in this sense, this town of officials and pundits and journalists and former officials doesn't know Trump, doesn't understand Trump Tower. They don't have a way in. And so when you don't have a way in or you don't have a grasp of what's really happening, you speculate and you also kind of misinterpret some of these moves.
I couldn't agree more. Now, Robert, you did not mention Vice President-elect Pence in the Big Four overseeing the transition. And what role do he and Reince Priebus play? Because they have organizational lines which are important, and are they also relevant to the transition staffing?
Very relevant. And I didn't mean to exclude them. What I meant by the four I mentioned were those I see as the core four around Trump himself. But Pence, in terms of capital with Trump, influence, Priebus, they are peers, and they are working closely with the president-elect. But the thing about Pence is he's really right now focused on the legislation, forming an agenda for the first 100 days. I was at the Capitol all day yesterday, Hugh. I met with a lot of senators, top committee chairmen in the House, and they think Pence is the key here for them. Pence is, of course, going to offer his counsel to Trump on cabinet appointees. But Pence has been a place for a lot of senators to go through to say, hey, maybe for this cabinet post, this is who could get confirmed. This is how much you could expect if you pick this person. So Pence is someone who really has a feel for the Hill, and that's his role, as well as being a counselor to the president-elect.
Tell me a little bit about the insider-outsider dynamic. I have been floating names that are outsiders, like Scott Pruitt of Oklahoma, to be AG, because he led the state AGs to fight back against Obama, but he's an AG for 6 years. And people like Andy Puzner to go over and take over labor, or Rick Cornell to go to the UN, or Jim Talent to go to Missouri. People who are not part of the D.C. deep state, I call it. How much emphasis is there on outsider versus insider?
I think there's a big emphasis on outsider. And one of the things I think why there's a reason, the confusion around this transition, is that dynamic isn't really being fleshed out in a lot of stories, because you have Bannon in there in Sessions, and they are outsiders. They like the Kris Kobachs of the world, and they like the people who come from the states. And so everyone's still, as you say, being vetted, and there's movement to contact a lot of people. And even a Ted Cruz, I mean, people are laughing on Twitter, but I hear he's seen very favorably, if he was willing to leave the Senate, to maybe be an AG or perhaps a nominee for the Supreme Court. And so there are people from the conservative movement, from the states, who are part of these lists. The challenge for the Trump team is they're facing immense speculation, 24/7 media, about what they're doing, who's in for what. And on many fronts, they're just not ready to make decisions. And that's seen as either paralysis in a lot of places and all that. But this is a group that's just starting to, a week later, grapple with the presidency.
When we return,
we don't want a presidential election system where New York and California can pick presidents for us.
The Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It's been 16 years since President George W. Bush won his first term, beating Al Gore by a whisker in Florida to claim those electoral votes and the election. The decision had to be sorted out by the United States Supreme Court. And then, 2016. Looks like Hillary will win the popular vote by more than a million. The losers of the popular vote were bitter then, and they're bitter now. In order to put those at least willing to listen at ease, my colleague Dennis Prager invited Tara Ross onto his program to discuss the many misconceptions about our election system. She's the author of Enlightened Democracy, The Case for the Electoral College.
Eric Holder has now announced he's against the Electoral College. Donald Trump sounded somewhat ambivalent with regard to it. I don't know. I don't think he's thought it through, which is the way it is. It is what it is. I think if he does think it through, he will realize how critical it is to the survival of this country as a republic. What do you think the current state of the Electoral College is?
Well, I'm anticipating attacks on it next year. This is the second time in 16 years that this has happened, and I kind of, you know, leaving people out of it just generically, I wish it hadn't been Democrats both times. But it has been, and I think the reason, though, is because the Democratic Party just needs to work harder at building coalitions. If you look at Hillary Clinton's numbers, she gets 16, I mean, it's changing because they're still counting, but the last time I looked, it was 16% of her vote from California and New York by themselves. So, I mean, that to me just kind of says in a nutshell why we're looking at the results that we're looking at. And I would argue that, you know, we don't want a presidential election system where New York and California can pick presidents for us. It's kind of interesting because sometimes those of us that defend the Electoral College, we go out there and say that. We say, do you want LA and New York picking the president for you, and people kind of poo-poo that and say that would never happen, but this is kind of what...
It's exactly what would happen.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you take New York and California out of the equation, then she's no longer ahead at all. She's behind by about 3.5 million votes.
Right, exactly. But it sounds good. And by the way, they would get burned just as they will. They did the nuclear option in the Senate. Oh, you no longer need two-thirds. It's just a clear majority. So now they'll get hurt because the Senate is in Republicans' hands. Democrats don't think long term. They don't understand that the Electoral College is just as likely to help them one day. But it isn't there to help Republicans or Democrats. It's there because states elect the president, not individuals.
Exactly. And there's important reasons for that. And, you know, over time, the Electoral College encourages both political parties to be healthy. I think they're both kind of unhealthy right now, just to be honest. But there are lessons to be learned from this year. I do think that Democrats are getting a pretty big kick in the pants. I hope that they will take time to learn about, okay, why couldn't we build a coalition? Why did such a big percentage, why is it so lopsided? Why are we getting so many votes from urban voters in these big states? What can we do to appeal to these people, you know, in Wisconsin and up there in the north so that they'll vote for us again? I mean, these are the kinds of things that the Electoral College is meant to spur the parties to think through what they're doing and to try to become healthier. Competition is good for everybody. And I really hope that everybody will stop and think this through. It is what happened in the wake of the Civil War years. There were several elections in a row that were kind of dicey, you know, like we're experiencing today probably, where it just feels like there's this permanent divide between red and blue. And how are you going to overcome this? It feels so permanent. But the Electoral College, I would argue, is one thing that forced the parties to kind of think outside of themselves. The Republicans could never win the Republicans had the default, but they knew that if they lost even one state, they were toast. The Democrats were in the flip situation where they could never win unless they got at least one state that leaned red. So they had to think about it. They had to think, what are we going to do to reach out to people that aren't like ourselves? And over time, that divide broke down.
Somebody needs to do the arithmetic. If every state allocated its electors by congressional district, I don't know that the Democrats would have won.
No, I haven't.
Because then there would have been electoral votes in New York and California for the Republican.
Yeah, I think it seems like the last time I looked at that, I haven't looked at that in a while. It seems like the last time I looked at that, it tends to make those margins even wider sometimes. Like I wouldn't be surprised if it upped Trump's electoral total, is what I'm saying. And
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
No, that's my point.
Yeah.
One of the oft-stated goals of nearly all of the GOP presidential candidates, and there were 17 of them, was the repeal and replacement of Obamacare. That's certainly one of our incoming president's top goals. But untangling this mess is going to be a complex challenge, even if you have the votes. Townhall.com's Guy Benson was sitting in for me on my radio show earlier this week. He turned to Tevi Troy, former Health and Human Services Assistant Secretary.
Let's talk about policy, because moving forward, it's been a major campaign promise of the Republican Party since 2009, 2010. We want to repeal Obamacare ever since it was passed. And a lot of the criticisms of Obamacare that were leveled at the time have been completely vindicated by events. And so now we've seen Republicans in the House and Senate on multiple occasions in their own separate ways, trying to get repeal bills through and to the president's desk. They finally did that in January, almost a complete repeal of Obamacare, a lot of the big chunks, using reconciliation, sort of this budgetary tactic that got around the filibuster. Obama, of course, vetoed it. It's his signature piece of domestic legislation. Now that there's going to be a Republican president, which we were told all along that is the missing piece, you need a Republican president who's going to be on board with this. Donald Trump, of course, said we have to repeal and replace Obamacare. Walk us through, if you would, Tevi, how this actually would look and how this would work in reality once the new Congress and the new president gets underway in January.
Well, first I want to say that you pointed out this key strategy that the Republicans have had over the last 7 years. Once they got the House, they put forward repeal bills and showed that a fully constituted House of the United States Congress was willing to put down this marker and repeal this legislation. Then, once they had the Senate, they went forward again, and they showed this is how it could get to the president's desk. So it's a series of steps. This is a long-range strategy that they got a lot of grief for over the years.
They sure did.
Bill Maher made fun of them. The Democrats made fun of them for yet another vote. But there was a strategic sense behind this.
And they were like normalizing this. We are going to repeal this. Get used to it. And it's not a big shock. To hear that Republicans might repeal Obamacare is not going to, you know, be greeted with wails of complete shock and horror by the American people because they're used to it and, frankly, they voted for it.
Absolutely. Nobody could doubt that this was on the agenda of the Republican president-elect, the Republican Congress. So this is something that was out there. And they kept it on the agenda, and they showed a pathway forward. So now we have the opportunity to move forward. There is a way to just repeal it, but you have to get to the issue of replace.
Exactly.
It's more difficult because the filibuster rules would probably apply. That means you would need 60 votes in the Senate rather than the House, than just the reconciliation, which needs 50. The president-elect spoke on 60 Minutes about how he wants to do the two together. He doesn't want to have a two-year transition period without any replacement. He wants to do the two together. So that is something that I think they need to work through right now.
Do you think that's the right approach, by the way? Do you think doing them in tandem is the correct way of going about it?
I was wary of this period of 2 years with the transition where you don't know what happens at the end of it. That leads to uncertainty. And also the Democrats could just say, well, we're not going to do anything and make you own it. So I think there is some value to it. But then the question is you have to figure out how to do it. And the other issue is that for people who really want this thing repealed, that means it doesn't get repealed in January. It's going to take a little longer.
Coming up,
we use our nuclear weapons every single day.
A military buildup could be coming soon when the town hall review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the town hall review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. We've witnessed the Obama administration's, quote, lead from behind strategy for 8 years now, placating bad actors, abandoning key allies, forfeiting hard-won gains. The sub-theme of all these years has been simply military downsizing. Many of us, but especially yours truly, have been hammering ever loudly against this approach. Under President Trump, Congress is ready to move forward to bring us back militarily. I turn to a friend and frequent guest on my radio show, Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. I am telling you right now that I like lists, and there's a list in front of me of potential secretaries of defense that include your name on it, which I don't think is possible because you would always sit on the Army side of the Army-Navy game. What do you make of these reports?
Donald Trump was just elected. He's going to make all these decisions about his White House staff and his cabinet in due time, and I think we should all give him the time to make those decisions.
That's what I've been saying this morning. When President Obama was President Obama-elect, he didn't name a press secretary until November 22nd. He didn't name Secretary of the Treasury Geithner until after Thanksgiving. And then all of his other appointments were made in December. What is the hysteria in the media about?
I think a lot of people in the media still haven't come to grips with the president-elect's victory last week. They're maybe going through the second or third stage of grief. Hopefully after the long Thanksgiving break next week, they can come back refreshed and with some clearer eyes about the new reality in Washington.
Now let's turn to the rebuild of defense. Coming up after the break, Captain Jerry Hendricks, retired USN, a great fleet expert, is going to come and talk about how you get to 350 ships in a 12-carrier battle group Navy and how you do so fairly quickly. Wrote a great piece in the National Interest about it yesterday. He's from the Center for the New American Security. Great guy. But you, of course, are on armed services, and you have to authorize all this, and someone has to appropriate for it. How quickly can we get the rebuild going, Senator Cotton?
Well, I think we need a running start, Hugh. I'm proposing $26 billion in emergency supplemental spending in the new year. That $26 billion will cover the remainder of this fiscal year up through September 30th, all of the needs that our troops overseas in places like Iraq and Afghanistan have, the training and equipping of those troops who may be getting ready to go overseas, what the Army refers to as a group called readiness, and it'll also fund all of the so-called unfunded requests that our services submitted to the administration and Office of Management Budget refused to fund. So that's a few more planes, a few more helicopters, a few more ships. That will be a bandage for the next 10 months. That'll get us through the end of this fiscal year, and it will allow us the time to review the kind of long, long-term, far-reaching reforms that we need to really substantially reinvest in our military, to get our troop levels in the Army back up to 540,000 from 480,000, to get our ships back up from 280,000 to 350,000, to get to 1,200 fighters from 1,100 fighters. These are all proposals that Donald Trump made, and they're very consistent with what many bipartisan experts have said our military needs.
Now, we can expect the return of the yellow journalism, which finds the $800 Pentagon hammer. We can expect that. But do you have confidence in our acquisition system's ability to rapidly mobilize to this? And indeed, there is a lot of criticism that the Pentagon is bloated with civilians and not staffed enough with the military. What do you think of both of those things?
Well, anyone who's served in the military, as I have, knows that it's an amazing institution that accomplished amazing things, but is also the biggest bureaucracy of them all. And if you listen to some of our more distinguished secretaries of defense in my lifetime, like Bob Gates, he writes about some of the challenges of managing the Pentagon, and that while they've undertaken some important reforms, there are more that could be undertaken. In fact, our defense bill that I expect to pass sometime in the next month tries to pursue some of those reforms, trying to reduce some of that overhead that's spent at the Pentagon and get more of those personnel slots out to the front lines, whether those front lines are in Iraq and Afghanistan or whether they're in our bases training the next generation of troops. I think those are very important because ultimately our military is there not primarily to fight and win our country's wars, but to stop those wars from ever happening in the first place. And you don't stop wars from happening with staff officers. You stop them with trigger pullers.
Now, your supplemental appropriation, your emergency appropriation, President-elect Trump talked about the need to refurbish the nuclear deterrent immediately because it's not been attended to. The Ohio-class submarine's got a replacement, SSBX, but it's not in the water or anywhere near it. Does anything go to the big three in your supplemental?
So those are going to be longer-term items, Hugh. Obviously, the Ohio-class replacement submarine is a 15- to 30-year project. The new B-21 bomber is on the same timeline. There is some immediate spending for our actual warheads and missiles and the command and control systems and so forth. Those are just all a little bit longer-term items. But as you say, they're ultimately the fundamental way that we deter conflict around the world. Some of my colleagues, sometimes ask why we spend so much money on weapons we never use, and I tell them they're wrong on both counts. We don't spend that much money. It's less than 5% of our total defense spending, and we use our nuclear weapons every single day.
Coming up.
So that's what motivated me to pick up a Bible, was basically my studies in astronomy and physics, because those studies proved to me there had to be a beginning to the universe. There's a beginning. There has to be a beginner. I wanted to find that beginner.
A scientist's unusual path to redemption when the Town Hall Review returns. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Hugh Ross is an astrophysicist. He's also an outspoken apologist for Christianity. Ross is well known as the founder of the organization Reasons to Believe. He's the author of several books, including his latest, The Improbable Planet. Dennis Prager spoke recently with Dr. Ross.
You are a religious, specifically Christian apologist in the best sense of the word.
Right.
You make the case for God and religion, and specifically deal from or write from your background as a scientist.
Correct. There's two books, the book of nature and the book of scripture that God has given us.
I love that. I don't remember you saying that.
Right out of the book of Psalms. So,
really? How does it say it there?
Psalm 19, where it says, the heavens declare the glory of God. God's words are written upon the heavens for all of us to read. So we have, God gives us two books. Both books are his revelation. Both are utterly reliable and trustworthy.
There are three positions. One is science and scripture conflict,
right,
or science and religion conflict. Another one is science is science and religion is religion, and they have nothing to do with each other. And the other is that, well, wait a minute, science leads to these beliefs.
Yes.
And you're of the third category.
Right. That they do,
and so am I.
They do overlap, and where they overlap, they agree.
Having said that, that doesn't mean that one opens up the Bible to learn chemistry.
Right. I agree with that. They partially overlap. They don't totally overlap.
Right. Okay, that's it. That, to me, is to say that they have nothing to do with one another is to, I think, denigrate the religion.
Well, what you notice is the Bible is composed of 66 books from a Christian perspective, 39 from a Jewish perspective. It's not one book, it's multiple books. And they overlap, but they also contain content independent of one another. Same thing's true of the record of nature. There are dozens of different scientific disciplines. They address different topics, but they overlap. And so it's no surprise to me that the book of nature overlaps the book of Scripture.
Yes, that it seems to make sense to me. Folks, when you hear, well, how could you be religious? Science says X, Y, or Z. What is your answer to that?
What's the question again?
How could you be religious? Science says X, Y, and Z, and the Bible says not X, not Y, not Z.
Well, I don't see it that way. I see them both saying exactly the same thing. And in fact, my story is my study of science have brought me to the book of nature. And as I read the Bible, that's exactly what it says the book of nature is designed people. It's designed to bring people to God's written revelation. And so that's what motivated me to pick up a Bible, was basically my studies in astronomy and physics. Because those studies proved to me there had to be a beginning to the universe. If there's a beginning, there has to be a beginner. I wanted to find that beginner.
Not using the Bible. How right. do you answer the atheist or agnostic who says, how can you use science to argue for a God when God is supernatural?
Well, science actually reveals supernatural intervention. I mean, what struck me right away when I was a young astronomer are the space-time theorems. The space-time theorem is based on only two assumptions, that the universe contains mass. You and I are living proof of that. And that the equations of general relativity.
By the way, I'm a bigger proof of that than you are, just for the record.
All right. Well, the second assumption is that general relativity reliably describes movements of bodies in the universe. Today, there's no doubt that that is true. It's the most exhaustively tested and best proven principle in physics. The conclusion of the theorem is that space and time have a beginning. Space and time are created, which implies there must be a causal agent beyond space and time that created everything, which is why my peers who are atheists in the physics community do recognize, and they've said this in print, that deism cannot be taken off the table scientifically. The force of the space-time theorems forces at least that theological position.
So let's begin with argument number one, the fine-tuning.
Yes.
So the atheist, I've had atheists on my show, on this hour, on the Ultimate Issues Hour, in fact, and they will argue, or one of their arguments is, well, obviously it's fine-tuned, because otherwise we wouldn't be here, but so what? So, you know, given enough planets in enough solar systems in enough galaxies, you're going to get this tuning.
Yes, but there's not that many planets and galaxies and stars. I mean, we're only talking 100 billion trillion stars and 100 billion trillion planets. Sounds like a big number. But when you look at the fine tuning you need just to make possible the existence of human beings without divine miraculous intervention, just based on what we know already, less than one chance in 10 to the 1,050th power.
Which is a lot more than a billion.
It's a lot more than 23 zeros. All you're doing is taking 23 zeros off that 1,050. So it doesn't make any difference. And so you really are stuck with the fine tuning. And I think what really is persuasive is how the fine tuning evidence goes up as you go from simple life to complex life to human beings. And what this book talks about, how it goes up even more when you're talking about human beings with a divine eternal purpose for being created by the Creator. That's where the fine-tuning goes through the roof.
Right. So we'll go to that and then come back to the fine-tuning. Purpose, I don't follow fully, because purpose is a religious or a value.
Right.
That, why is that science-based? Isn't that a leap of faith? I take leaps of faith. I have no problem with that. But why are you using science to advocate for what I think is just a leap of faith?
Well, that's where you get the last chapters of the book really lay that out. The book kind of takes you to a climax where I make the point, for example, that if you want a planet with billions of human beings living on it at one time, you have to be living in an ice age cycle. It must be an ice age cycle with a 100,000-year period. How do you get an ice age cycle with a 100,000-year period. How do you get it at the time when the sun is most stable in its luminosity phase? And what you discover is you need unquestionably miraculous events all to happen simultaneously, not just a few, but a whole bunch. And so now you can kind of see the handiwork of the Creator in opening up this tiny time window in which billions of us can exist. When I say tiny, it's only 9,000 years wide. It may go for another 1,000 years. That's another requirement. To have billions of humans here at one time, you need to have extreme climate stability.
Coming up.
When she turned her back on them, she turned her back on America.
A widow's perspective on Hillary's Benghazi cover-up on the final segment of the Town Hall Review. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Secretary Clinton has been plagued by numerous scandals. The homebrew server, the Clinton Foundation, and pay-to-pay allegations, there are others. But the Benghazi albatross will hang around her neck for many years to come. Today, there is ample evidence implicating her gross negligence in handling the September 2012 disaster that cost the lives of four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador. Larry Elder spoke recently with Dorothy Woods. Her husband, Ty Woods, a Navy SEAL and CIA operative, died in Benghazi.
We've seen the heavy assault on our post in Benghazi that took the lives of those brave men. We've seen rage and violence directed at American embassies over an awful internet video that we had nothing to do with. It is hard for the American people to make sense of that because it is senseless. And it is totally unacceptable.
Dorothy, when you hear that, what's your reaction?
Well, you know, I've had 4 years, a little over 4 years to think about it. And, you know, every time I hear replay, I see something new. And to be honest, in listening to that now, I really just see her reading. You know, I just really see her sort of going off talking points and just really creating, you know, a favorable robotic narrative of the events that happened that night that, you know, agreed with her.
Dorothy, it'd be easy for you to shy away from publicity, not get involved in politics, not campaign. I met you in this tour that we did, we meaning you and Sheriff David Clark and Jesse Jane Duff, a 20-year military vet, another man named Carl Higbee, who had been injured in Iraq, had 80% disability. All of us were campaigning for Donald Trump. Why was that important for you?
Well, you know, it was important for me because I wanted to give the public a piece of the puzzle. I wanted to give them information about Hillary Rodham Clinton. You know, I had a personal experience with that woman. I can attest to some of the decisions she did not make when she was in the position to save American lives or affect change overseas when we were in crisis, when Americans were under attack. And I think that her actions, or lack of action that night, should translate into her resume of not really being able to be our commander-in-chief. So it was very important for me to get that story out, the personal side of that, so that the Americans who maybe were wavering, maybe had made the decision to go either way, at least had my piece of the puzzle. That was very important for me. And I think that that could have been, I tell people, that could have been her defining moment as Secretary of State. But instead, she chose to turn her back. And when she turned her back on them, she turned her back on America.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review. Tell a friend, sign up for a podcast of our program at townhallreview.com. And be sure to follow us now on Twitter at Town Hall Review. That's Town Hall Review. For executive producer Russell Schubin and producers Charlie Richards, Derek Fowler, and Dwayne Patterson, I'm Hugh Hewitt. Join us again next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the Week in Review program from a perspective you can trust.